Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hey there, it's Chris Bentley, host of Here and Now Anytime. Let me ask you a quick favor. It's easy, but important to me and everyone who works on this show. If you like that we're here every afternoon, bringing you fresh perspectives and insightful conversations on the big stories of the day, take 5 seconds and follow Here and Now Anytime, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. And if you want to make us really happy and help other people find this show, leave us a good review. It really helps. And thanks. Now here's the show.
Even though this leftist community is very small, from that seed can grow something and can grow a recognition that this calamity is horrifically unjust.
Police arrest anti-war protesters from California to Israel. It's Monday, April 29th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, threats against election workers continue despite new laws meant to protect people at the polls. And Doris Kearns Goodwin has written defining biographies of presidents, but her latest bestseller is about her late husband, Dick, a speechwriter for JFK, RFK, and LBJ.
And I found out even more than I knew that he was like Zelig in the 60s. He just seems to be everywhere where you'd want somebody to be. You'd sort of say, there's Dick Goodwin. How did he end up there in every place along the way?
Doris Kearns Goodwin coming up in about 20 minutes. Before we get to that, though, at UCLA, campus police broke up a fight between students protesting the war in Gaza and counter-protesters. In Washington, D.C., city police declined to take up George Washington University's request to arrest protesters in a tent camp for trespassing. But elsewhere in the country, several hundred people were arrested over the weekend during other college protests against the war in Gaza. And there are also protests happening in Israel. In a few minutes, we're going to hear Deepa Fernandez's conversation with a rabbi who was arrested there last week. But first, to California State University Polytechnic Humboldt, where students have been barricaded in a school building for a week now, and police are preventing anyone from entering the campus. We heard from two people at Cal Poly Humboldt. First, a student, Zachary Meyer, a senior who supports the pro-Palestinian protesters. He's also Jewish. Here's what he told Robin Young.
For the Israeli government, I want to see an end to indiscriminate bombing of children and people in Palestine and Gaza that are just trying to live their life. Palestinians just want peace. They want their homelands not to be bombed. They want to stop being occupied by the Israeli government. And that's what I want to see. I want to see peace. I want to see an end to the state-perpetuated violence.
Well, let's pick that up, because other Jewish students in colleges across the country don't feel as safe as you apparently do. And some would say not all Palestinians want peace. They point to Hamas. They hear some protesters supporting Hamas. They hear calls for change from the river to the sea, for instance, and the Anti-Defamation League, as you are well aware, sees that as anti-Semitic because it calls for dismantling Israel and removing Jews to create a Palestinian state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. So what do you say to those Jewish students who feel this is existential for them and they feel threatened?
Yeah, I mean, I feel that. I have plenty of friends that are both Israeli and Jewish, and we talk a lot about this, and also with my family. But I think in any sort of movement like this that is global, and there's a lot of hurt feelings on both sides, like it's war, it's death, it's violence. People are going to have a lot of strong opinions, and I think this is all just a call for peace. And I think if anyone is calling for the death of someone, they're either backed up against the wall or not speaking on behalf of the core of this protest.
Look, your graduation is coming up May 11th. It's reminding a lot of us of another May when students were killed at Kent State protesting the Vietnam War, and all the graduations across the country, every single one just about, was canceled. Overall, how were you feeling about these standoffs?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up Kent State, and I'm a huge Neil Young fan, so I've been listening to Ohio pretty on repeat, teaching myself how to play it, and it is the 54th anniversary on Saturday, and there is definitely a fear. I see the call, people calling for the National Guard to come in all sorts of places. You read the comments on Facebook telling people to come in and tell these students what for, and I think that's a disgrace. University campuses are places for difficult conversations, for people to speak up and learn. I don't want to see more students be killed in classrooms. I thought we're supposed to be against that.
Well, so far, lots of violence and scuffles, but so far, not that. Zach Meyer.
Yeah, luckily.
Yeah. Zach Meyer, senior at Cal Poly Humboldt. Thank you.
Yep.
Well, now let's bring in Jeff Crane, dean at the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at Cal Poly Humboldt. He's been negotiating with student protesters for this past week. Dean Crane, Jeff, we know some are asking that those occupying a building there not be charged for that. What else would you want us to know about what's going on right now?
So I've been in dialogue with students, student protesters, from the beginning, but we moved into a phase of non-negotiations as of Saturday with a hard lockdown. And so one of the asks is not to be charged, and that's a hard thing for us to address because we aren't responsible for the legal system. What I do know is that faculty have really rallied to let students know that they're going to support them, provide them resources. I believe the university would probably do that as well. I want to say, actually, the students on their own, when we met last week, on their own offered to clean up and paint over the graffiti. Mm. And I think, you know, there's some discussion about what role service on campus could play in mitigating any academic sanctions.
Yeah. Well, you floated the idea of a committee with faculty and students to do a deep dive on the calls for divestment. You know, what does that mean to you very briefly? Because Columbia is being asked to divest billions from companies in Israel or businesses profiting from this war. Cornell and Yale protesters are asking their schools to divest from weapons manufacturers. Just briefly, what do you see the students there asking for?
Well, so, yeah, Portland State just cut off their relationship with Boeing. It's not a significant amount of money, but it's meaningful symbolically. Mm. Of course, I'm old enough to remember the student protest movements asking for divestment from South Africa because of apartheid, and that was quite effective. And so the students want us to research our investments, of which we have like 0.5% of our endowment is in direct investment, and then also our donors. I have made a very specific and clear commitment to create a committee of students, faculty, and staff. I put a timeline together and a student rep that would co-chair that committee with me starting in early May, and also, you know, pay a student to do research over the summer. And I think that's the way we pivot from protest to the work that needs to be done to get to the next point.
Right. Well, and we're going to take up divestment in a much deeper way. It's a hard thing to do. But I just want to ask you, there's this perception that this is kind of an ivory tower thing that's happening. You know, at Yale, at Columbia, protesters are elites, can afford to do it. You know, some young people have been saying, I can't afford to lose my, you know, scholarship. We know, by and large, Humboldt students aren't wealthy. Many are students of color or the first to graduate in their families. What do you want people to know about the kids, your Humboldt students?
These are not wealthy elites. These aren't students with trust funds and a firm that they know they'll get a job in when they leave. So I think they're taking some chances. And I see the aspiration. I mean, I see the principle, and I have a lot of respect for that.
Jeff Crane, a dean at Cal Poly Humboldt, who's been in conversation with the student protesters occupying a building there. Dean Crane, Jeff, thank you so much. We wish you all the best there.
Thank you. We need it. Appreciate it.
While concerns continue regarding anti-Semitism during protests, more American Jews are speaking up, joining ceasefire protests and expressing solidarity with Palestinian and Muslim communities. Author Ayelet Waldman is one. She was born in Israel, now lives in California, and is known for her novels and essays on motherhood, among other subjects. On Friday morning, she and six others were arrested by Israeli police for taking part in a peaceful protest with a group of rabbis. They marched towards Gaza at the Erez border crossing. She was carrying a bag of rice. They were all released Friday night. And Ayelet Waldman joins me now from Tel Aviv. Ayelet, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ayelet, tell me why you traveled from California to Israel and what your protest at the Gaza border hoped to achieve.
I've been feeling for the last 6 months a sense of profound powerlessness. I was horrified by the events of October 7th. I want to make that clear. But what has been happening now in Gaza is a horror like I have not seen in my lifetime. And it is a horror being done in my name and in the name of every Jew in the world. What we did was bring one pickup truck full of food. But what we were saying is our Jewish values require us not just to feed ourselves, but to feed the stranger. And this food is a symbol of what the world, and we in particular, must give to the people who are now undergoing unimaginable suffering.
And what happened when you arrived at the border crossing carrying a bag of rice as you were, but with a truck of food behind you? Was it allowed in?
No, of course not. And we knew that it wasn't going to be. So we approached the Erez crossing. We got off out of our cars and we escorted this pickup truck full of flour and rice. And we walked as close as we could. We were greeted by police and we were pushed back. And eventually a number of us were arrested and I was arrested.
You were right there at the border with Gaza. I think the feelings you're describing of powerlessness many in the country here have felt. What was it like being right there but not being allowed to go in?
It's such an interesting thing that people don't necessarily understand. These are very small distances, but the actual distance of experience and emotion is infinite. I mean, I'm in Tel Aviv and I just had a beautiful lunch surrounded by wonderful people having beautiful meals. And in Gaza, there is whatever food is coming in is utterly insufficient to feed the people. And it's not just about the food that's coming in. It's about a people who have been starving and need medical care and there needs to be an infrastructure. The crazy contrast of that in your brain between what's happening in Tel Aviv and what would happen if you got in your car and you drove an hour and 15 minutes, it makes your head explode.
Ayelet, this is such a polarizing war. Many in Israel want Hamas rooted out. They want all the hostages home. We've also heard that the human toll being exacted in Gaza is not widely reported in Israel. I'm sure you're talking to many people while you're there. What are you hearing? And how do you talk about your desire for an immediate ceasefire, for a peaceful coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians?
There is a small community of Israeli activists that put their lives and their freedom and their reputations on the line, and they know what's going on. And they suffer reputational, you know, people don't want to be friends with them. They criticize them. They call them traitors. I have been told again and again that the Israeli media doesn't report on the extent of the death. It's easy to deny because these statistics come from the Hamas infrastructure. But we live in a connected world, and it is really easy to put Gaza famine into Google and to see what's going on. And if you don't do that, it is because you don't want to know. I think the easy thing that I've heard people say here is a version of they brought it on themselves.
And what do you say to that?
I say that a four-year-old child whose limbs have been amputated is not a combatant. And I will say that I have heard people say there is no such thing as a non-combatant. They're future Hamas members, you know, but that is an expression of a lack of humanity that comes from a place of trauma. And I don't believe that expression I can't believe that it can continue forever. I do believe that there are, even though this leftist community is very small, I do believe that there that from that seed can grow something and can grow a recognition that this calamity is horrifically unjust and horrifically out of proportion.
Writer Ayelet Waldman, arrested last Friday during a protest at the Gaza border in Israel. Ayelet, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I mean, I'm going to get emotional, but thank you. Thank you for covering this.
And Here and Now reached out to the Israeli police, but they did not return a request for comment by our airtime.
We'll continue to follow this story as we have been. You can find a lot more coverage at hereandnow.org. Coming up next, 1 in 6 election officials has been threatened in recent years, according to the Brennan Center for Justice survey in 2022. After the break, we'll check in on the situation facing poll workers as the 2024 presidential election approaches. Stick around.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Many states will start early voting in about 5 months. And with the election coming, some states are also considering legislation to protect people who work at polling places. At least 18 states have passed bills since 2022 that punish people who threaten or harass election workers. NPR's Chris Arnold spoke last year with a worker in Coos County, Oregon, who says he was terrified when an armed woman in a Jeep followed him as he was collecting ballots from drop boxes and tried to run him off the road.
I see the Jeep Gladiator turn around the corner and drive very quickly down the road and then slam on the brakes and skid to a stop just past me. And then she leaned out of the car and looked at me and yelled, "You traitor."
Jonah Minkoff-Zern is co-director of the Democracy Campaign at the nonprofit Public Citizen. And he told Deepa the problem is widespread.
1 in 3 election workers surveyed in 2022 knew someone who had left their job running elections because they didn't feel safe. In some states, more than half of the local election officials have left since 2020. In Arizona, 12 of the 15 states' county election chiefs have departed.
I'd love for you, Jonah, to just paint a picture for us of who an election worker is. You know, I know every time I've been to vote in various cities in various parts of the country, they just seem like people from the community. I mean, where I used to live, it was, you know, people from my kids' school. I wonder if that's representative of election workers across the country, or are they partisan political operatives?
No, the election workers are people who care about being civil servants, and they are often elderly people who want to be part of our political process, and often people of color. You know, this is a racial justice issue as much as it is an issue of making sure that our democracy is working. And these election workers are not partisan people. They're people who care about the outcome of having a free and fair election.
So can you give us a specific example? We heard one just in the intro to this piece of a worker who was threatened.
Sure. So Pennsylvania Secretary of State Al Schmidt received threats that Trump supporters intended to kill his children and put their heads on spikes. And he's a Republican. In Oregon, a county clerk's office was vandalized with the message, "Vote don't work, next time bullets." An election worker in Georgia received threats to his family in January 4th of 2021. The threat stated, "We hope you enjoyed this holiday because it will be your last."
I have to ask you, Jonah, this is shocking. Is this new, or have these kinds of threats, you know, maybe even just in a low-level form, always been leveled at election workers?
This has been happening since the 2020 election, and it's a result of Trump's refusal to accept the outcome of the election. And what's notable is that this has continued to happen, that election denialism, that false claims that elections are not being decided fairly have continued to dominate a narrative that are having this outcome.
So, Jonah, what are states doing to prevent this? And can you speak to how effective any of those efforts maybe have been thus far?
Sure. So it's fantastic to see that states are taking action. These laws say make it illegal to threaten and harass election officials. They protect their personal information. And it's states across party lines, so ranging from Indiana and North Dakota to Vermont and Washington, that have passed these laws. And more needs to be done. We need to pass federal laws to protect our election officials. We need to also speak out as individuals against election denialism and say that we have our election officials' backs.
So hearing, you know, all of this, I have to wonder, is it even safe to be an election worker for the upcoming election this year?
Absolutely. Election workers have been able to administer our elections safely and effectively. And we believe that in the 2024 election, that these laws and other actions like the Department of Justice task force that's investigating threats and harassment to election workers are important actions to make sure that our elections can be administered safely and fairly.
Jonah Minkoff-Zern is co-director of the Democracy Campaign at the nonprofit Public Citizen. Jonah, thank you.
And thank you, Deepa.
Coming up, Robin recently sat down with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin to talk about her latest book. And this one is not about a president, but her own late husband, who was a speechwriter for JFK, RFK, and LBJ. It's part historical scholarship, part love story, and we'll hear all about it when we return.
On the TED Radio Hour, researcher Sasha Lucioni says AI can help us find climate solutions. But just training the technology itself uses a ton of energy.
Training ChatGPT, for instance, emits as much carbon as 5 cars in their lifetime.
Tech's climate conundrum. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Do you wish stories could unfold over 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? You tired of doom scrolling? Trying to find humanity? Or maybe a deeper understanding of why the world is the way it is? Listen to Embedded, NPR's original documentary series. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt, because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Drake and Kendrick Lamar have been lobbing some serious accusations at each other. You've probably heard the diss tracks and wondered, what's just a low blow and what's actually criminal? I'm Brittany Luce, host of It's Been a Minute from NPR, and I'm getting into what's art and what's worthy of criminal investigation and who those accusations hurt the most on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Hey,
Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin has written best-selling books about Lincoln, JFK, LBJ. She now adds another bestseller and another great American, her late husband, presidential speechwriter Richard Goodwin. A self-described Jewish kid from Brookline, Massachusetts, whose family struggled financially, Dick sold Fuller brushes door-to-door and was a fry cook on Revere Beach to get to Tufts and Harvard Law. He went on to write for men whose vision, ending racism and poverty, matched his. His words gave their goals majesty. Over time, he filled 300 boxes with letters, tapes, photos. He was going to write a book. After he died in 2018, Doris, frozen in grief, turned those boxes into the biography, An Unfinished Love Story. We sat down at a sold-out event at WBUR's City Space, and I described Dick. Okay, Dick Goodwin. He had untamable eyebrows, a piercing intellect as he aged, a chiseled face that looked like it got up and walked off Mount Rushmore. And had there been a Mount Rushmore for speechwriters, he would have been up there.
Oh, wow.
And did you know that Dick swam naked in the pool with LBJ? And out of that encounter came his phrase for LBJ's vision, the Great Society.
Well, what really amazed me when we went through these 300 boxes, he was afraid of opening them because the decade had ended so badly. It was really a time capsule of the 60s. So finally, when he turned 80, he came down the stairs one day. He's singing from Oklahoma, "Oh, what a beautiful morning," still having shaving cream on his ear, typically. And he said, "Okay, I'm going to open the boxes. It's now or never." So we spent the last years of his life reliving the 1960s through the boxes from beginning to end. So we suspended our knowledge of what would happen later. That's how you have to do it as an historian, right? Not know that. Barbara Tuchman said, even if you're writing about a war, don't know how that war ended. And I found out even more than I knew that he was like Zelig in the 60s. He just seems to be everywhere where you'd want somebody to be. You'd sort of say, there's Dick Goodwin. How did he end up there in every place along the way?
Dick served in the military before graduating number one at Harvard Law, not at all excited about working in a stultifying firm. Doris found a picture of his class. Who's in that picture?
Yeah, look at that picture.
Well, he's in the middle.
He's in the middle holding the baton. 60 guys on the Law Review and two women. If you look on one side, it is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And on the other side is a woman named Nancy Boxley. I found this picture right after I had read a letter that he had written to his friend George saying that the law firms all over the country are competing for him. It's a real burden of choice. And I went running into him when I found this. I said, "What? This is maddening. Ruth Bader Ginsburg couldn't even get an interview for a law job. And you are having a burden of choice." He says, "Not my fault. It's not my fault."
Dick would clerk for Supreme Court Justice Frankfurter and, still in his 20s, land a job at a House committee where he'd uncover the 1950s quiz show scandal, contestants like Charles Van Doren given the questions and the answers. Later, Dick would write about it. Robert Redford made a movie. Rob Morrow played Dick.
And I remember when the movie was finally made, Redford said to Dick, "What did you think of the movie?" He said, "How could I not love it? I'm the moral center of the movie. I'm played by a handsome young guy. It's the best."
In the late 1950s, Ted Sorensen asked Dick to write a speech for then-Senator John F. Kennedy's presidential campaign. Dick would go on with JFK's team to the White House. So Dick Goodwin, right after the inauguration, 29, he's going to check out his office in the White House, and there is JFK checking out his, the Oval Office. It's just the two of them. JFK turns to his new young speechwriter and says what?
He says, "Did you see the Coast Guard contingent in the inaugural parade? There wasn't a black face among them. We must do something about that." So that was Dick's first assignment. And then he thought, where is the Coast Guard? What does it do? It's in the Treasury Department. The first black was allowed into the academy. He became an honor student, and his name was Merle Smith. It was not easy.
Dick would then be put in charge of a Latin America initiative. He'd take a private meeting with Che Guevara, a diplomatic misstep. He became a confidant to Jackie Kennedy, suggesting she have a party for all the living Nobel Prize and many Pulitzer Prize winners, Frost to Oppenheimer. In another picture, Dick escorts the First Lady in formal wear into the ball.
This is one of his favorite pictures. You can well imagine it hung on the wall and for a long, long time.
It was Camelot. Then, horribly, It ended. After Kennedy was assassinated, Dick, now 33, scrambled to help prepare the funeral.
And because of his friendship with Jackie, he followed some of her desires to have the body, when it came back in the East Room, look like it did when Abraham Lincoln was there. So they had to go to the Library of Congress in the middle of the night. They had to have flashlights to find a magazine which described exactly how it was when Lincoln was there. And then he was in charge of getting the eternal flame.
It was crushing. And then there was the tension between the JFK and LBJ camps.
So one of the conversations was recorded with Bill Moyers, LBJ's aide. Johnson says, I need a new speechwriter here, somebody who can put sex into my speeches, somebody who can use great Churchillian phrases. And Moyers says, well, the only one I know is Goodwin, but he's not one of us because he was a Kennedy, but LBJ brings him over. Moyers says to him one day, the president wants us to talk to him about his vision for the Johnson program because he had already begun to get the Kennedy programs through this tax cut and the civil rights bill. So Dick said, so we're going to the Oval? He said, no, we're going to the White House pool. And there is Lyndon Johnson swimming up and down naked in the pool. And he says, come on in, boys. So they strip on the spot. And now three guys are nakedly swimming in the pool. Finally, they stop. And Johnson then gives his vision of America. Medicare, Medicaid, aid to education, civil rights, voting rights, NPR, PBS. It's amazing. And then they have to decide what to call it. So somebody in the White House wanted to call it a better deal instead of a new deal. Someone else wanted a glorious society. But Dick tried out the Great Society in a number of small speeches, and it caught on. And the Great Society lives everywhere around us still today.
He also was the right man for the racial disruptions that we were seeing that were a long time in coming. This has come to be known as the We Shall Overcome speech. It's after these events of the marchers at Selma being beaten and everyone watching it on television. Let's listen.
What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
That's in Congress. Dick decided to use Martin Luther King's words there. What did that mean?
Yeah, what it meant really is you're taking the anthem of the civil rights movement, an outside movement pressuring the government inside, and bringing it to the highest channels of power. So he sat in his office that day. He told everybody, you've just got to leave me alone. Nobody can bother me. And at one point, he just took a break, and he went to take a walk, and he heard in the distance some people singing, We Shall Overcome. And that's how he thought about using the anthem at that moment.
Dick Goodwin and LBJ grew apart over the expanding Vietnam War. Dick went to work for Eugene McCarthy, the quixotic anti-war candidate. Then Johnson shocked the country, announcing he wouldn't run again. Robert Kennedy jumped into the race. Dick joined his best friend and was with him when he also was assassinated.
I think really in a certain sense, when Bobby died, Dick's dream of what was possible in public life died for a period of time as well.
Well, there would be columns, editorials. When the Supreme Court decided George Bush won the 2000 election, Dick wrote Al Gore's healing concession speech, reaching back to what Stephen Douglas said to Lincoln in his.
I'm with you, Mr. President, and God bless you. Well, in that same spirit, I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country.
As Doris said to us, can you imagine that now? Dick Goodwin was a Kennedy guy. Doris, 12 years younger, would become LBJ's close confidant and biographer. When they started the box's journey, they shook hands on a deal that they'd wait to the end to see how they felt. So I asked her, start with Dick. What happened?
The resentments that he held because of the war really were poisoning him in a certain sense. And then one day when we went through those boxes, especially the ones that had to do with the Voting Rights Act and all the Great Society legislation of 1965, I could feel that something had broken within him of that anger. And then he finally said, oh my God, I'm beginning to feel affection for the old guy again. I think it allowed him then to remember what he did too. And then meanwhile, I had begun to feel the inspiration that JFK, when he was young, provided. So I was feeling better about him. And I think for both of us, it meant a lot. So after a period of time when I just was paralyzed and couldn't figure out if I could do this, I started up again from the beginning and was able to finish the book. And I'd like to think he'd be proud that I had done so.
Oh, I'm just going to leave us with the last words you heard from Dick. You are a wonder. Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Thank you so much.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, her book on her husband, presidential speechwriter Dick Goodwin, is called An Unfinished Love Story, A Personal History of the 1960s.
That'll do it for us today. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. Today's stories were produced by Thomas Danielian, Lynn Menegon, Ashley Locke, and Emiko Tamagawa. Today's editors were Peter O'Dowd, Micaela Rodriguez, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
With NPR Plus, there's more to hear, like extended interviews with some of the experts we talk to at Planet Money and The Indicator.
It's a mistake for economists to only think about economic efficiency when considering policies, because you'll actually wind up with a worse outcome.
And with NPR Plus, you help keep NPR going. Learn more at plus.npr.org.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.